Hello.
Hi, can I speak to Dr. Coatsworth, please?
Speaking.
Hi, Dr. Coatsworth. This is Matt Levin.
I'm
the student who sent you the letter.
Yes.
And wanted to know if I could catch you for a few minutes.
Sure.
Or maybe a couple more in a few minutes, but hopefully not forever.
Okay.
First of all, I just wanted to ask you, do you mind if I tape record the conversation?
No, not at all.
Okay, good. Because I'm not a very fast writer.
I don't know how helpful I'll be, but...
I mentioned in my letter that, you know, some of my subject matter is having to do with the civil rights movement, but that's kind of just one aspect of what I'm doing. It just happens to be kind of the project that I'm working on right now,
uh-huh.
or the part of the project that I'm working on right now, but it's kind of a larger project, so... anyways, well, we'll see. I mean, I'm not looking for magic answers, so... anyways, do you mind if we just start with some quick biographical information, like
sure.
when, what years you were in Madison?
Let's see, I arrived in September of 1963.
Okay.
I left to do dissertation research in Mexico in January of 1968 and returned just briefly for 3 months during the summer of 1969, June, July, and August.
Okay. And you were a graduate student in Latin American history?
Well, I actually started out as a graduate student in U.S. history.
Okay.
Working in diplomatic history with William Appleman Williams.
Okay.
And I drifted.
Somewhere along the road, you moved. Okay. And you weren't from Wisconsin, were you?
No.
No.
No, I was born in New York, and, that's a purely formal fact. My parents moved out before I was old enough to be consulted. I grew up in Ohio and Connecticut.
Okay, so... Ohio, Connecticut, okay. Great. So you came to Madison in fall of 63. Now, I read in the Daily Cardinal that somewhere along the road, and maybe in 63, you took a trip to Cuba.
Oh, yeah. Actually, my college roommate and I saw an ad in a radical paper called the National Guardian.
Uh-huh.
I forget whether he saw it or I did. Which said, if you want to go to Cuba this summer, call this number.
Yeah.
So we did. And eventually we ended up flying to Havana via Prague.
Okay. It's quite a roundabout trip.
Yeah, from New York with, I think the total group was 59 American students.
Okay.
Protesting the travel ban.
Okay, so it was a kind of a deliberate protest of the travel ban that the State Department had issued.
And then when I got back to the States, the one person from Madison I knew with was, or I had a contact with, was James Weinstein, who at that time was editor of Studies on the Left.
Okay.
And somebody I knew gave me his number. I called him, and he put me in touch with various folks in Madison, mainly for the purpose of helping me find a place to live when I arrived.
Okay.
I stayed for the first week I was in town with Clark Kissinger, who was the president of the Socialist Club.
Right.
In Madison. And he thought it would be a great idea if I were the club's first speaker that fall.
Okay.
So that was it. That's why you read about it in the Cardinal.
Right. So you had these connections to some of the characters on the, kind of in the I don't know, the leftist community on campus, James
yeah.
Weinstein, Clark Kissinger. Were you a part of the organizations that they were involved in, or were you kind of just an acquaintance of theirs or a friend of theirs?
Well, let's see. I don't know if the Socialist Club actually have members, but I went to all of his meetings.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I don't think it had members.
Okay. Right. That's the impression I got.
At a certain point, it kind of faded and was replaced by a kind of series of other organizations, all of which were active in one way or another.
Okay.
On the left, including SDS and the Committee to End the War in Vietnam and so on.
Okay. So when you came to Madison then, I mean, you had this experience of going to Cuba, but did you anticipate getting involved in kind of campus politics or...
Yeah,
yeah you did.
Yeah, I was... I didn't belong to any group and actually never joined. The trip to Cuba was, it turned out, a project of progressive labor.
Okay.
Before they had become a party, they were then sort of a movement.
Okay.
Which had attracted, as I recall, a good number of young people who had been in and around the Communist Party, often from communist families, but who thought the party was too old and stodgy.
Okay.
And who were sympathetic to the third world, maybe a bit to China as a result.
Okay.
I when I was in Cuba, I didn't know there was that the Russians and the Chinese were disagreeing about it.
Right.
So I kind of going to Cuba is a sort of political education for me.
Okay. Okay.
But I never joined PL.
Okay.
And although at one point I think my wife was the only non-communist member of the executive committee of the Committee to End the War in Vietnam, we didn't join the party either because it was so secretive. No one told us.
Really?
I had a rule that you couldn't tell anybody you were a member of the party unless everyone else in the group in Madison agreed.
Wow, that's an interesting rule.
And there was always someone who objected to telling anybody, so it didn't grow very much.
So who was involved with the PL in Madison then?
I don't think, well, there weren't many. It was just a small group. They had a kind of friend organization called the May 2nd Committee.
Okay, right.
And the same sorts of people in Madison who were in the socialist club or around it and sort of impatient formed the May 5th Committee. And I think I must have been part of that because, as I recall, the only thing that the May 2nd Committee, the only thing we did was to have a demonstration on May 2nd.
Okay.
Protesting, I think it was the first anti-war demonstration in Madison.
Right, 1964, yeah.
And I was sort of the only speaker. There weren't very many of them, and there were about 50 of us that marched around with placards.
Okay.
Which the good folks of Madison politely ignored.
Of course.
So they all sat down on the steps of the Capitol, and I made a sort of short speech, and then we all went home.
Okay. Then that was, as far as you recall, kind of the first protest or rally concerning U.S. intervention in Vietnam.
Yeah, that I'm pretty sure of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it was before Johnson announced the major escalation.
Right.
I can't remember. I guess it was after Kennedy had been assassinated, but there weren't all that many folks in Vietnam.
Right. Still kind of quiet at that time. Now, I know you said you spoke to the Socialist Club after you came back from Cuba that fall, and I think I came across something else where you spoke to another group or two later on.
The weekend, the day I think that Kennedy was assassinated, I was supposed to speak to the Lutheran student organization. And I did.
Wow. It went on, huh?
Yeah, right. It went on anyway.
Were people on the campus interested in Cuba, or was it something, the revolution or the invasion or attempted invasion, or were these things that people were interested in, or were they kind of in the background?
Well, I guess the talk I gave in the fall of '63 was less than maybe it was 11 months since the missile crisis.
Right.
So there were maybe 500 people that turned out.
Oh, really?
Including, it was, Clark told me it was the largest turnout they'd ever had.
Wow.
He did a very good poster.
Good advertising, huh?
And they just plastered the campus everywhere. And the trip that I'd been on had been in the news a lot over the previous summer.
Right.
We'd actually been denounced by John Kennedy at a news conference. and there was interest in Cuba. And it wasn't yet, it hadn't sort of hardened into the framework of the Cold War in people's mental maps. They still saw Cuba as something that was sort of sui generis and different and interesting and rebellious maybe well-intentioned.
Students did?
Yes. There were actually some faculty that turned out as well.
Oh, okay. Okay, so there was a little idealism about what might have been happening in Cuba.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, lots of interest.
Okay.
I gave a rather boring talk.
What were you talking about? Just your impressions of what life was like and changes that had come about since the revolution and things like that.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And when you took the trip, was it a very casual trip, or did you actually get introduced to certain people in the Cuban government and things like that?
Well, the Cuban government was thought we were just great.
Oh, really?
And in fact, it was the Federation of University Students that paid our airfares.
Oh, wow.
And a Cuban tourist agency that covered room and board while we were there. So it was, and so we were given the tours, and we met, well, Fidel Castro came and played ping pong with us at our hotel, and, and we met most of the, a good number of the people in the cabinet, Che Guevara, who was then Minister of Industries, Raul, who was, I guess then had already gone to his position in defense, and in the armed forces, and various others, including the head of the Agrarian Reform Agency, a great guy named Carlos Rafael Rodriguez, and various others, the editor of the official newspaper, and so on.
Right.
And they found a bus, and they took us to various parts of the interior. So for about a month, leading up to the 26th of July, we spent a lot of time outside of Havana and touring the country.
Is that that isn't where you went to do your dissertation research, is it? You didn't return to Cuba.
When we all got back in August, we arrived back on the day of the March on Washington, Martin Luther King's March on Washington.
Yeah.
Too late to get to the Washington to participate.
Yeah.
maybe it was the day after. I guess the day after. And everyone had their passports lifted. So eventually we sued to get them back.
Uh-huh.
They were returned because they were seized in violation of the law, actually.
Right.
According to the Supreme Court. But that meant that when I had wanted to do dissertation research in Latin America, I had to find a place to go to that I didn't that didn't require a passport. And the only country in Latin America that didn't require a passport was Mexico. So I've been a Mexican historian ever since.
Now that's an unusual story for the evolution of your interests.
Yeah.
So you were aware. I mean, I don't know if anyone wasn't aware that the March on Washington happened in August '63.
Yeah.
I know that you maybe weren't all that involved in civil rights activity on campus, but...
Oh, no, we had, in the basement of the place where we lived on St. James Court, had, at least in 1963, the only mimeograph machine, I think, on the left.
Ah, you were very popular, huh?
Clark Kissinger lived in an apartment on the first floor,
uh-huh.
And then when I got married the following spring, he moved away, he was moving away. My wife and I moved into his apartment, and the mimeograph machine was owned by a fellow on the second floor. His name was Ken Knutson, who was an anarchist, pacifist, vegetarian, and who allowed the left to use his machine, but was very careful about the causes that were supported. So we couldn't run a leaflet in which we wanted to argue that the the National Guard should be sent to someplace in the south. After the bombing in Birmingham, I think some organization, maybe I don't remember which one.
Right.
We wanted to run off a leaflet saying that Kennedy should send the National Guard into Birmingham, and he wouldn't hear of it.
Were you then involved in? I mean, maybe just loosely. And I mean, there were all kinds of small demonstrations or marches or rallies or meetings where SNCC workers came. Those were things that you generally went to. Was that something that, you know, was kind of the same folks that were involved in Time and Time Again and the same folks that were involved maybe in the Socialist Club and things like that? Or, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was the same kind of community that was doing that stuff.
Yep. And a high proportion of sort of out-of-towners.
Yeah.
out-of-state students.
Yeah, I kind of wonder where the in-state students were in all this, but I guess they kind of came on the scene a little later in the decade, maybe.
Although there were some in-state students who came from left-wing families.
Yeah, yeah. I think Eugene Dennis was from Wisconsin.
Yes, and
he...
so was... the party had a relatively large group in Milwaukee for a time.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't know that.
And the son of the head of the Wisconsin Communist Party was a nice guy whose name I can't... It was a German last name I can't remember.
He was in Madison, though.
What's that?
He was in Madison.
Yeah. His father's name was Sid something or other.
Huh.
So there were some from Wisconsin who, because there had been some kind of, Wisconsin had sort of a history of political activism on the left.
Right, right.
And so there were some, yeah.
Let me go back a little bit. Why did you, coming from, originally from New York, but more from Connecticut and Ohio, how did you end up at Madison as a graduate student?
I went to Wesleyan University in Connecticut as an undergraduate. And became sort of progressively more sort of radical and dissident in my views, I guess. I guess I ended up going to Madison because, there were sort of two steps. One step was I majored in history, and it was one of the few things I thought I was both interested in and reasonably good at.
Yeah.
If I hadn't gone to graduate, if I had gone to graduate school or professional school in a program that took less than 5 years, I would have been drafted.
Right.
So a strong incentive to go into a PhD program
sure.
was the draft.
Right. Was that already an issue in the early 1960s?
Well, it was if you were on the left and didn't want to invade Cuba or some other place. So,
okay.
it was also a sort of more general issue. People made decisions about what they were going to do at the end of their college years based on how to fit in 2 years of military service somewhere.
Gotcha.
So some people did it right away. Some people went to law school and then went to the service afterwards.
Right.
So it was part of everyone's thinking.
Okay.
And various folks had various ways to escape. Even then, and often not for political reasons at all.
Right.
So one question was whether to go to graduate school or go, you know, to be a labor lawyer or something more useful. And the draft sent me to Madison, I think.
Okay.
And so then I looked around for professors who were sort of on the left or
right.
critical, and William Appleman Williams was among those.
Right, right. You weren't. Were you aware that he was at Madison before you came here?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
I applied to Madison actually to study with him.
Oh, okay. Okay. I've come across a few folks that seem to be at least part of the motivation. His presence here.
I mean, if you read Studies on the Left and you, which was published for a long time,
right,
moved out of Madison before I arrived.
Right.
And any of his work, it was an obvious place to go.
Right. Right. Okay. Did you actually read Studies on the Left before you came to Madison?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, okay. Okay. So it wasn't... sometimes I wonder who exactly was reading that. I'm not... I suppose someone was. I know it was a national journal, but I sometimes wonder.
Yeah.
Okay.
It didn't have a very large subscription list, but it...
Right. It got around, probably.
Yeah, sure did.
A lot of that stuff just gets passed from hand to hand, probably. Okay, well... So you were participating in kind of the first, probably the first anti-war protest on campus or anti-Vietnam protest on campus in 64. And then that kind of changed gears in 65, in the spring of 65 when Johnson ordered the bombing of North Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And there were, you know, several rallies, several vigil, things like that on campus in that year. And at least in the Daily Cardinal, you're kind of your name comes up as kind of one of the key organizers of this initial flurry of activity.
Yep, sure was.
So you had been interested in Vietnam before, so this was just kind of a natural evolution.
Yeah.
It wasn't something that was sudden. They're bombing North Vietnam. We should do something. It was.
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. What was there? I mean, the Vietnam issue kind of brought a lot of people. Did it bring people into the left, or does it? I'm trying to get a picture of, you know, whether there was, you know, whether Vietnam kind of was responsible for what kind of happened on campus in the middle and late 60s in terms of kind of this outburst of activity that went on, or whether there was some kind of precursors to that that might give an indication that something was going to happen regardless of Vietnam blowing up.
Well, I was not as involved in civil rights activities, and my my recollection is that there wasn't a huge, there wasn't a lot of it, but there were, but folks that were involved in anti-war activities were also involved in whatever protests and organizing went on in civil rights, and the two kind of fed into each other.
Okay.
Folks that would turn up at civil rights demonstrations also turned up at anti-Vietnam demonstrations. The people that appeared when we invaded the Dominican Republic and protested that would turn up at civil rights civil rights marches. The folks that went south in several summers, I didn't go, but some of the people that we raised money to send folks into the south for registration drives.
Right.
When they came back, they gave talks on what they'd experienced, and the people that would listen to them would also tend to show up at other activities sponsored by related organizations.
Okay.
And my sense of it was that there was a kind of gradual expansion of the number of people who were listening and paying attention and interested, but that maybe the point at which, if there was a sort of a leap, it might have occurred when there was the big sit-in at the administration building over the draft.
Right.
Supporting grades to the draft board.
Right, I think that was in the spring of 66. Okay, so that was kind of...
But there had been a lot of activity before that.
Right.
Which, as you can tell from the Cardinal, was it got reported, so...
Sure.
The campus was generally aware that there were these odd folks there.
Yeah, the Cardinal did a pretty decent job of, it seems at least, of covering what was going on.
I agree.
Maybe because the left is making the most noise.
Yeah.
I don't know that the Cardinal was all that sympathetic to what they were saying.
I mean, it was a quiet town, so...
Right. That's true. That's true. Were you actually involved in the... it seems like, from what I've read and heard, that the Committee to End the War in Vietnam was kind of emerged out of those demonstrations that took place in February of 65.
Uh-huh.
Were you actually involved in that organization, or...
Yeah, I went to all of his meetings, I think.
Okay.
I may have been an officer at some point.
Okay.
I know my wife, Pat, was a treasurer.
Okay.
The treasurer for a while.
Okay, so that was kind of the center of the anti-Vietnam protests. That organization kind of was the center of that. Maybe you can explain to me a little bit what the committee did. With the organization, how it kind of approached the issue and tried to accomplish its goal of ending the war.
Uh-huh.
I mean, was it just protests? Was it, you know, every month or so a protest or a march or something like that, or was there something beyond that that was taking place?
Well, there were. The first thing the committee did was to have meetings and sponsor speakers and.
Mm-hmm.
Organize marches.
Yeah.
So that the sort of kind of standard things that all the student organizations did. If there was anything innovative about it, it was from time to time, the committee actually noticed there was a larger community out there. So I remember when Johnson escalated and announced the first. Well, first there was the bombing, and then there was the dispatch of the first huge contingents of American troops.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going door to door in neighborhoods in Madison, asking people to sign a letter to their congressman, Kastenmeier.
Really?
The senators. It was a good experience for many of us who did it,
mm-hmm.
because we got off the campus and met some interesting folks.
All right. Did you get a decent feedback from?
Yes.
Yeah. Really? Okay.
That's where I learned about political generations in American politics. Anybody between people between 30 and 50 were really quite uneasy. And didn't sign.
Huh.
And the older people were, the more they signed, and the more, I remember one little old lady told us that she thought that she would sign it, but she didn't think it was strong enough to like. So if you were under 30 and sort of over 60, maybe, you were likely to be sympathetic. And then there was that dreadful generation that seems to have had its political socialization in the late 40s and 50s. It didn't want to be involved in anything.
Yeah.
So... That was, I think, a bit innovative. The other that was innovative was that the committee had a kind of speakers bureau. We tried to send people out to community organizations. I remember I once gave a talk to the local Elks Club, I think. They were very polite and very disapproving. we had dorm speakers.
Okay.
and out of that kind of ferment, and maybe out of some of the as a result of the larger number of people who were listening, it was the same, essentially the same group of people that organized a student political party called the UCA, University Community Action, and ran candidates and actually did very well.
Huh, okay. You have a good memory of names and organizations.
Hang on a second, I've got to answer the door, Alex.
Sure, sure.
Sorry, man.
Oh, no problem. Did you need to take care of something? Or?
Yeah, somebody rang the doorbell.
So. Oh, okay.
I think we ran Paul Soglin, who had become a sort of a campus politician, got his start with this organization.
The UCA.
As the University of Wisconsin's representative of the National Student Association.
Huh, okay. I think I still see Paul Soglin on TV every once in a while here in Madison. He's still around. I'm kind of wondering if there were any debates when you were on campus, you know, in 63 to 65 or 66, about how to proceed with kind of affecting change. I mean, there seems to be kind of this general kind of gradual kind of ratcheting up of the level of activity that students are doing, the marching, rallying, later sitting in, getting a little more obstructionist, maybe.
Yeah.
Was that just kind of something that happened, or were there conscious debates about that?
Oh, they were really quite conscious debates.
Okay.
So, if I remember well, hang on a second, there's another call coming in. I'll
sure.
Be right back.
Okay.
Still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Oh, no problem. I you know, I'm interrupting your morning, so I appreciate any time you give me.
I've talked about this for a long time. I
bet.
There were debates, and I don't want to sort of exaggerate my own role, but there were the people who won the debates,
uh-huh.
the people who wanted to escalate confrontation.
Uh-huh.
And the people I remember most were Evan Stark,
mm-hmm.
who was a sociology graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy by the name of Robert Cohen, Bob Cohen.
Okay.
Whose name also has probably come up from the...
Right. Both of them have.
And they tended to win. I generally took the other view.
Okay.
Which was that I actually was not against confrontation at all.
Mm-hmm.
I was perhaps mistakenly in favor of... planning it better.
Okay.
Picking targets in a way that communicated more readily to the press and the community.
Okay.
So, for example, I argued against obstructing recruiters from Dow,
okay.
the chemical company,
mm-hmm.
And said that we ought to, because this would not, and that we should do it when the CIA came to recruit.
Okay. So it was a strategic issue?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
And the... Evan and Bob and the others who wanted to start to do it to obstruct the Dow recruiting made the perfectly plausible argument that, you know, if there aren't if you're going to do one, you might as well do the other.
Yeah.
So since there wasn't an issue of principle but rather of strategy,
mm-hmm.
Or tactics, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And people were quite impatient with the way the war was developing and so on.
Right.
I generally tended to lose these debates.
Yeah. but that's interesting. That's interesting. So.
But they were quite explicit. They were quite open.
Uh-huh.
They were prolonged. There were votes.
Okay.
Should we obstruct? Should we not obstruct?
Okay. So it was a very deliberate, conscious project that was going on.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you understand. In the end, in effect, the votes didn't matter.
Yeah.
Because if I'd won the vote by some majority that said don't obstruct Dow Chemical,
yeah,
Evan and Bob and their friends would have obstructed anyway. So looking back at it, I'm not sure it made any sense to participate in the to get involved in the tactical debates, because the those who were in favor of more radical action,
uh-huh.
often, we're not going to go along with what the majority said anyway.
Right.
That probably had a better sense of how to do that than I did.
Right, right. That's interesting.
Or the other folks that were more concerned about, you know, how the community and the larger and the media were going to think about us.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I did read an article in, you remember the magazine Connections?
Oh, yeah, very well. Paul Greener was its editor.
Yeah, I read an article in there, and they talked briefly about this kind of debate occurring before the Dow demonstration. And
yeah. But it occurred over and over.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine. Did now, okay, so this was kind of a strategic issue. Now, there have been some, you know, I keep getting these kind of from the general body of scholarship that's out there about the New Left in the 1960s and radicalism. There's this impression that, you know, maybe even by 1964 or 1965, the New Left, or even before that, the New Left was kind of anti-intellectual or non-intellectual. Does that make sense? Does that make sense in the context of Madison or?
No.
Okay. I'm not sure it does either. I'm kind of grappling with that question.
Well, I think there was a kind of progression.
Mm-hmm.
In which, as things got more polarized and people got more frustrated and unhappy with various trends, that that the skills and the ideas that tended to dominate activity
mm-hmm.
Could certainly leave that impression.
Okay. But there was more going on. Is what you're.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Okay.
There was also a sort of ebb and flow.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever there were periods of time when it was clear there was uncertainty and there were newspaper editorials and press coverage was shifted a bit, and when decisions hadn't been made, and then big decisions like the bombing or the escalation
mm-hmm.
would take place, and then for a period of time the media and even public opinion would tend to sort of rally around the president, and for 6 or 8 months you couldn't get anybody's attention.
Right.
And there would be a sort of ebb and fewer demonstrations, and people would get discouraged. And during those periods, the more hyper-organized, disciplined organizations on the left,
mm-hmm.
in Madison, usually the Trotskyists, eventually
right.
Progressive Labor. The Trotskyists were the Young Socialist Alliance,
mm-hmm.
Progressive Labor, and others that were kind of pig-headed about the world in general,
mm-hmm.
and with a tendency to be more disciplined than the rest of us, and maybe to some extent anti-intellectual, especially PL, would tend to they kept showing up for meetings, and other people would get discouraged and they wouldn't come for a while.
Right.
Until some, you know, new outrage occurred. So there were periods of time when the Trots got elected to chair and to run the committee of the end of the war in Vietnam, and
mm-hmm.
then something would happen, and more people would show up at meetings, and they'd kind of get voted out or overwhelmed.
Okay.
So I think it was, there always was a kind of intellectual, anti-intellectual element on the left,
mm-hmm.
and in the American left in general. But it tended to be a minority, I think.
Okay.
Although it tended to be, you tended to see it among people who were less worried about sort of community opinion, more radical in a tactical as well as a sort of strategic sense.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and a lot of the anti-intellectualism when it occurred was very intellectual.
Yeah.
Evan Stark's speeches were, for example, classical.
Yeah.
Like Weber, Marx.
Yeah.
And Marcuse and so on.
Right.
For points that were essentially anti-intellectual.
Right. Yeah, I'm not convinced that this is, I don't know if it, maybe it applies to other places that you know, non, that weren't Madison. I don't know if Madison was somehow unusual or not, but anyway, it's just an idea I'm playing with.
Yeah.
Let me just, a couple more questions, then I'll let you go. I also get the impression from stuff that I've read and people that I've talked to that the left in Madison was kind of a social being or social organization, as well as kind of an intellectual and activist organization. Does that ring? Does that seem to ring true with you, or for you, or?
If you mean in the sense that that the people who are on the left tended to socialize with each other.
Yeah.
At occasionally there were sort of parties, or we'd get together with sort of potluck dinners, independently of our political activity.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
Okay.
What I can tell you is it. Is that a lot of the people that we tended to socialize with were also other graduate students,
mm-hmm.
or maybe and eventually faculty as well, who got involved in the movement,
mm-hmm.
And would sort of have people out to their house,
right.
or fundraising. We are already recruiting. We're always trying to recruit faculty to their houses for fundraising events.
Right. Right. Which faculty were interested? Do you recall?
Yeah, William Taylor in history.
Okay. Now this is in the late 1960s. This is by the middle and late 1960s.
Yeah.
Okay.
This would be in 65 to 68.
68. Okay.
Well, to start at the top, I suppose Maurice Zeitlin,
mm-hmm.
Harvey Goldberg.
Okay.
Bill Taylor in history.
Yeah.
Peter Weiss in psychology.
Okay. Now they kept kind of a low. They probably kept kind of a low profile. Maybe they helped you do fundraising. They came. No.
Zeilin would give a speech at the drop of a hat.
Really? Okay.
A very loud and outraged tone of voice.
Okay.
We always had him at rallies.
Okay.
Bill Williams came and gave a very short speech. And a very curious one, only once, and that was when we had seized the administration building.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came and talked to the maybe 1,500 to 1,000 folks that were sitting on the floor of in the lobby of the administration building.
Mm-hmm.
And was not terrifically active in organizations at all.
Right.
Hardly ever came to meetings and so on. Then there were others that, that were kind of peripheral, but came and went.
Okay.
There was a period of time when Edward Feige in the economics department got interested in civil rights and the left.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of backed off, I think, later on. And used to debate students of the left. George Mossy in history,
mm-hmm.
had a lot of left-wing graduate students,
mm-hmm.
But was never really part of the left himself.
Okay.
There are probably others I could remember, but
sure.
A lot of folks would sign.
Okay.
Would eventually ended up signing petitions and letters to congressmen and so on.
Right. Was there a point, I mean, you left, you said, in the beginning of 68 and then just returned briefly in 69. Was there a point while you were on campus that you can recall kind of becoming disillusioned with what was going on, or were you generally kind of in the middle of what was going on and were supportive of the activities that kind of the left was carrying out?
Yeah, I was in the middle and supportive, I
suppose. Okay. Okay.
I occasionally felt unhappy at when we did something dumb,
mm-hmm.
or got outmaneuvered.
Yeah.
But we didn't do that a lot.
Okay.
And the left grew rather dramatically while I was at Wisconsin. So even though there were periods of kind of ebb and flow, there was never a time when I felt at all disillusioned.
Okay, okay.
And if the truth be known, I haven't since.
Good. That's interesting. I imagine you've read some of these, or maybe you haven't, some of the recollections, you know, 20 years later, 30 years later, of kind of veterans of the 1960s, some of whom have taken back what, you know, have regretted what they did, and some of whom are still, like yourself, very you know, don't regret it at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you seen the book about written by or edited by Paul Buell about Madison?
I didn't read it thoroughly, and a lot of the book was about the period before I got there.
Yeah, a good portion of it was. That's true.
Harriet Tansman had a piece. She's the one that sent me the book, actually.
Oh, okay.
Because we had sort of cooperated in this little committee that, in this little May 2nd committee that organized the 50 people to march.
Yeah.
In what was the first protest against the war.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember her mentioning that in her piece. Okay, well, great. Is there anything that, just before we finish up, is there anything that, you know, we have, that's kind of come to your mind, but that I haven't specifically asked about, or you haven't mentioned, you know, any?
I did. There was a documentary done about this period that kind of ended up with the violence, which I thought was in some ways well done, but in others a bit simple-minded.
Yeah.
So I'm glad somebody's looking into it again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's you know, really interesting. I guess not coming of age in a political generation that, you know, this is very unusual. So it's exciting in some ways. I mean, I don't want to get too romantic about it, but it's exciting for sure.
Well, it was fun because it coincided as well with kind of generalized turbulence in society. Which
right.
Was, in a sense, that student political party we organized was tapping into.
Yeah.
I think that did actually more than that, maybe in the draft issue.
Yeah.
The grades issue did more to sort of get the left an audience during the period than almost anything else.
Huh, okay.
And the student political party fed off of complaints about in loco parentis rules and all of the other constraints that teenagers don't like.
Right, right. And I can't blame them. I can't blame them. Yeah, because we don't have those things anymore, really.
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
I don't think anybody nowadays recognizes that this was one of the more outrageous things the left at Madison and other universities were demanding.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was I'm a teaching assistant, you know, the past year or so, and been telling, you know, as I go through these old Daily Cardinals from the early 1960s, I don't know if you remember, but they used to have, kept coming across pictures of these blonde women, and, you know, it'd say Beauty of the Day underneath it, and I wasn't paying much attention, but I kept seeing them and seeing them and seeing them, so finally I took a look, and I couldn't believe, you know, the Cardinal every day was printing pictures of a woman and with kind of, interesting captions, let me put it that way, underneath. So I was telling my students about this. They got a good kick out of it. So.
Yeah, it was a different world.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Anyways, thank you thank you so much, Dr. Coatsworth, for talking to me.
And good luck on the project.
Thank you very much. Of course, if I have any other questions, I might give you a call, but sure. Probably not, and I really appreciate your time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
Bye-bye.